3 points of introduction in getting into 1 Samuel chapter 19. First is keep in mind that David has now emerged as a hero in Israel. And of course, it's been the slaying of Goliath that's one of the greatest displays of power in the Old Testament. When you come from chapter 17 into chapter 18, we noted last time that 18 is really a sequel to 17. And it's a sequel in the sense that when you come into chapter 18, you have the fierce jealousy of Saul that begins to develop and will eventuate in his attempts from here on out to his death in chapter 31, from here on out his attempts to chase and kill David. So you've got the slaying of Goliath, David is a national hero, the nation is rescued from the Philistines, and in chapter 18, the jealousy begins to rise on the part of Saul. And as it does, it eventuates in his taking his spear and trying to pin David to the wall. And that continues on through the rest of the book. Chapter 19 deals with some of the means and methods that God uses and used with David to deliver him. For example, let me read one and then show what it compares to coming down to the attempt to kill Saul in David in chapter 19, verse 11. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be put to death." So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. And that looks like just sort of an interesting little story of how his wife, the house is surrounded, his wife finds a window, she lets him down, and David walks off into the dark. And it sounds like just an ordinary, everyday, human sort of thing without any particularly deep spiritual truth to it. As a matter of fact, when you go on, she puts the teraphim under the bed with some goat's hair on it and throws the covers over it, and she's going to pretend that David is sick. And you look at all of that and you say, well, I don't particularly see the hand of God in that, and I wonder what in the world David was thinking as he was sliding down that rope or whatever it was she let him down with, and what was he thinking, what was on his mind as he goes out into the darkness of the night. So reading it again, verse 12, Michal let David down through a window, he went out and fled and escaped. Now, keeping your finger here, let's show the deeper insight that the book of Psalms gives us to an event like this. Psalm number 59. If we can say it this way, many times the historical books of the Old Testament will record events, and frankly, when they record the events, God isn't in it. You just don't see that at all. And the event with Michal and letting him down through the window and her little devices are amusing. They're interesting to read and to look at. But you look at it and say, well, what's the spiritual lesson involved in it? And very often it's Psalms that gives us the spiritual insight. So look at Psalm 59, beginning with verse 1. And the verse 1 does not begin with, if you have a Bible like mine, with the word deliver in great big D, about looks like 18-point type. That's not verse 1. Verse 1 starts where it says, for the choir director. And if you are reading a Hebrew Bible, that would be verse 1, and then the verses would be, versification is different. So notice this. This is for the choir director, set to Al-Tesheth, a miktam of David. Get this. Here's the occasion. When Saul sent men, and they watched the house in order to kill him. So here in Psalm 59 will be David's thoughts. Now, we don't know whether David wrote Psalm 59 on that night. I doubt that he went out there in the woods and as he got down at the bottom, he said to Michal, throw me my pad and paper. I'm going to do a little writing tonight. And as he went out into the darkness, he wrote this psalm. We don't know when he wrote it. We do know this is what he thought that night. And this was what is in his mind. And so it will be interesting to get the insight. So what we'll do is turn to that a little bit later in our study this evening. So as David flees Saul, we're going to be given insight into David's faith and David's trust. Now, as far as the structure of chapter 17 or 19, it revolves about four escapes. And the four escapes are 19:1-7. And the main instrument there is Jonathan. Jonathan goes to bat for David when Saul is going to take his life, and as a result, David is delivered. Then we have chapter 19, verses 8-10, which is his second escape. And basically, in this escape, it's his own feet, David himself, his own maneuvering to deliver himself is the focal point. Then the third event is in 19:11-17. And basically in verses 11-17, his wife Michal is central. Then in the final attempt on his life and his delivery is in verses 18-24. And the central figure there is Samuel. So we could really outline the entire thing around the four escapes of David, and each one is distinct. What we'll be doing tonight is going through the first three, and when we get to the third one, since the setting for the third one is also the setting for Psalm 59, we'll go to Psalm 59. And then we'll come back and do the last one, and we'll integrate the Psalms as they come up in historical occasions along this line. So tonight, we'll go through the first three escapes of David for his life from Saul, how they came about, some lessons from them, then we'll go to what was he thinking that night as he was let down the window and he slips past the guards around his house, goes out into the night, perhaps to sit down in a Judean hillside around Bethlehem that would be brilliant with light and lots of rocks and places to hide. And as he lies down there that night, knowing that Saul is going to try to take his life in the morning, what went through his mind? What was he thinking? And we will look to Psalm 59 to find out when he was what he was thinking. And he was certainly thinking a lot because he perhaps recalled this later and said, I remember that night and I'm going to write a psalm about it. And as I write the psalm about it, the things that happened to me and that I thought through are so important that I want everybody in Israel to know about this. And so he says, I commission it for the choir. The choir is to sing it. And so all the people can have it on cassette tapes in their cars and they can play Psalm 59 because Psalm 59 will also apply to them. All right, let's go now and caption 1 Samuel 19. The theme of it is basically this: David's responses to Saul's wrath. David's responses to Saul's wrath. Now, I don't know what you have in your notes from last time, but I somehow hope that maybe at least part of your notes from last time you have lost. Because as I concluded last time, I mentioned that in chapter 19, 20, and 21, it seems as though David really has a setback as far as his faith is concerned, because he seems to be trusting all of these human resources and so forth. And when we went through a series on the life of David, I went back and looked at my notes and I had captioned chapter 17, the battle is the Lord's, then came over to chapter 19 and called it, the battle is David's. Well, I think all of that is wrong. And the thing that blew all of that good, solid, erroneous teaching was realizing realizing this time through that Psalm 59 was written on this occasion. When you see Psalm 59 and what David expresses in there, there's no way that this man has had a lapse of faith. So this is going to be simply looking at the human side, and the Psalms will give us the divine side. I think David is still very much trusting the Lord, and he is responding to the wrath of Saul. So we begin with our first instance, and the first one is Jonathan's intervention for David. Jonathan intervenes. Chapter 19, verse 1. Now David told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. Now that can easily be misconstrued. It looks like Saul wants to kill him, and he says to Jonathan, I want you to kill him, and then tells all of his court, I want you also to be engaged in killing him. And that simply does not pan out with the Hebrew. When you come down to verse 1, it would be something like this if we would express the way the Hebrew has it. Maybe you have a Bible that has it this way. Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all of his servants of his intentions to put David to death. And the way the little "to put" construction is in Hebrew leads to that line. Does anyone have a translation that reflects that? That is by far, I think, better. It's not that it cannot read the way it is said here, but it just isn't the most likely Hebrew usage of it, and most commentators will agree with that. So Saul lets his intentions be known. He makes them public to his son Jonathan and to all of his servants that he's going to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, and I want you to note at this point, in intervening for David, Jonathan does three things for his friend. Number one, he informed David. Two, he advised David. And third, in the heart of it, he interceded for David. Now, looking at each one of those, they do give an interesting picture of what a true friend will do for you. First of all, notice that he informed him. Verse 2, Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. And so, in other words, he gives him information. Now, the first question that come up is very important since he is his friend. When should a friend inform another friend, and when should he not inform another friend? Well, I think this passage gives us at least a clue, and the clue is simply the fact that the information was critical to Jonathan's well-being. He needed to know that. So one of the guidelines, and when should you inform a friend that something is about to happen to you? You should inform a friend, if you're a true friend, when that information is critical to them. And yet that takes thought, because one of the most cruel things that we can do is to inform someone of something that someone has said about them when there's no purpose in it. You can be very, very cruel if you've heard somebody be very critical of a friend of yours, and then you decide to go and tell them. That's not kind. That's the time to keep your mouth shut. That's cruel. But at this point, the information was critical as far as David was concerned, and Jonathan knows that, and he informs his friend. He also went ahead, notice, and he advised him. He says, now therefore, please be on guard in the morning, stay in a secret place, and hide yourself. And again, we should ask the next question that we ask on the first one, is when should we advise a friend? And the answer to that is probably as a general rule. Never, never give advice unless asked. There is nothing worse than unsolicited advice. And yet at this point, there's no solicitation on David's part. There couldn't be, because he didn't know this. So his life was involved. He informed, he advised him, and then he said, all right, I've informed you, I've advised you. Now, frankly, I don't want to get involved anymore with this situation because it's dangerous to my health. Notice he interceded for his friend. He was willing to get involved. So, verse 4, then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand, struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? So notice he carefully intercedes for David on the part of his own well-being. So again, good information on what a friend will do for another friend. When they're in danger, they will inform them of anything that is dangerous to their well-being. If advice is forthcoming, you will say what can be done to forego this, and if you can possibly intercede or do anything for them, you're willing to do so. I think it's very interesting that Jonathan did not have the 20th century let's not get involved mentality. If there are occasions, as we later, when acting in this way on the behalf of David nearly costs Jonathan his life. So he is a friend in the fullest sense of the word. He doesn't ask, if I make this move, what will it cost me? He doesn't count the cost. David's a friend. Jonathan loves him, and that's the way a true friend always, always acts. Now let's put down a note then, coming down to the next verse, that the move has at least temporary success. Because verse 6 says, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed. Notice he does not just promise, this is a vow. As the Lord lives, or so help me God, or our old American, I swear on a stack of Bibles, he shall not be put to death. Now again, if we know anything about jealousy, we would look at verse 6 before we get there and say, it won't work. Because you see, there's a principle involved. We'll come to it in just a moment. But notice there is at least a temporary success in that context. Now, it's not but just a short time later. In fact, we have one, two verses, and we come down to verse 9, which says, there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing on his harp with a hand, and Saul tried to pin David to the wall with his spear. So let's put down a couple of lessons that we can learn off of this. And the first one is this, and we'll put it in the form of a question, and that is, was Saul insincere in verse 6? Was he insincere in his vow? In other words, in verse 6, when he takes this vow, was this tongue-in-cheek? Was he saying, I don't mean it. I got kings. My fingers are crossed. I just want you out of my hair, Jonathan. So I make a vow that he will not be put to death. Was he not sincere, or was he sincere? Well, when I read verse 6, I don't get any indication of insincerity, do you? I don't think we have anything in the text that would show us in verse 6 that Saul didn't probably mean what he said. Now, if that is not the case, then the vow in verse 6 and the breaking of it in verse 9 and 10, then we have a tremendously important lesson that is involved here, and that is this. Jealousy is more powerful than sincerity. Jealousy is more powerful than a vow. And what that does then for us is to say, here's a man that honestly said, so help me, I will not slay David, I promise. And then jealousy begins to work on him, and his resolve to keep that vow suddenly vanishes. And again, it's a very, very important lesson on how very, very strong the sin of jealousy can be and how very dangerous it can be. Second lesson off of this, and that is, Jonathan here gives a beautiful picture of balance. Jonathan shows balance. And what he shows balance between is balance between prudence and principle. Balance between prudence and principle. Now, what do we mean by that? Notice in the way Jonathan worked things, he was true to principle by being loyal to truth and loyal to his friend. He was also prudent in that he didn't do anything to create suspicion on Saul's part, did he? He didn't do anything to turn his hand. He didn't do anything to indicate that, well, I'm going to go to David with this information. He was prudent enough. He knew what not to tell. He knew what to stand for. He knew when to take a stand, and he knew when to be cool, to use our terms. He knew when to stand on a principle and when to be wise in the way he did it. So he looked at Saul, and he was wise in the way he handled it. He could have been one of these people that have all principle and no sense, and come in and said, all right, Saul, I have talked with my friend David, and I am going to be loyal to my friend David no matter what, and I want to argue with you and say you shall not kill him. He didn't do that. He didn't say anything about their friendship, about their conversation. He was principled, but he was also prudent at the same time. And that's simply a very, very good lesson in knowing how to keep a balance between. Do you ever meet people that are so principled that they're aggravating? You just want to say, do you have to be so obnoxiously principled to the point that everyone is uncomfortable? And Jonathan was not that way. He was loyal to David. He was loyal to truth. He told the truth. He didn't tell Saul everything. The reason he didn't tell everything is that he was also prudent. He also had good sense, and he was also wise in his method. All right, that then is our first event where Jonathan intervenes, and notice David comes back to the court, verse 7. Then Jonathan called David. Jonathan told him all these words. Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. He is delivered by means of Jonathan. All right, our next delivery coming up is in verses 8 through 10. And this is Saul's attempt to kill David. Now, between this first incident and the second incident, we've got a transition verse. The transition verse is verse 8. And you might want to ask, why is verse 8 even there? You could have gone back to verse 7 when it says, Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. Verse 9, now there was an evil spirit from the Lord as he was sitting in his house. And you come down to verse 9, and you've got David, where we had David in verse 7, in the court of Saul. And so verse 8 could really be clipped, and you could go on to verse 9, the incident, and they fit very nicely together. The question is, why has the Holy Spirit put in verse 8 and given us a transition verse? Well, notice what it is a transition between. It is a transition from the vow in verse 6, and we have the new attempt to kill him coming down to verse 9. And in between, we have the content of verse 8. Now, why is it significant that verse 8 goes between the promise not to kill David and the new attempt to kill David? Well, verse 8 tells what lit Saul's fire so that he gave up his vow and tried to kill David. And what was it? David had more success. And there's nothing that feeds jealousy like more success on the part of the person of whom we're jealous. So verse 8 gives that transition verse. It says, when there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter so that they fled before him. And what is that going to do to Saul? It's going to be new fuel for the fire. And the vow that he made in verse 6, we can now understand that the thing that causes the new attempt on David's life is David's new success. So we have the vow not to kill. We have David's new success in battle. And we then have the new attempt on his life. In other words, the success of David again fuels the fire of Saul's jealousy, and he is about to kill him again. It's very interesting also that the only link between the vow and the attempt to kill David was success. And what that really tells us is how bad Saul really was, in that we have only one event in between these two. Well, this time, notice David is delivered by his own dexterity, because you come down through to verse 10. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, though he struck the spear into the wall. And again, this time, instead of Jonathan delivering, it says David fled and escaped into the night. And that leads us to the third incident, and this is the incident with delivery by his wife Michal. 19:11 through 17. And this, remember, is where we'll branch off as he goes into the night into Psalm 59. So we're looking now at 19:11 through 17. Keep in mind now that as we go through these verses, chapter 19, verse 11, is the historical setting for Psalm 59. It's this historical setting for Psalm 59, as we have already looked tonight. So verse 11. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. And that sentence now becomes the setting for Psalm 59, but let's complete down through this attempt, and then we'll go to that particular psalm. The events of these verses revolve about three sets of messengers. Three sets of messengers. First of all, the first set comes to guard the house till morning. So this, we'll just call the guards. That's in verse 11. This will provide Michal an opportunity to attempt to rescue David. She's going to let him down through a window, and she then has time to create the little scene in the house. Down through verse 13, Michal, with David now going out into the night, took the household idol, or the teraphim. And again, you can say, what is a household idol doing in the house of David? And the answer to that is, I don't know what a household idol was doing in the house of David, except to say, there was a household idol in the house of David. I, of course, coming from the male standpoint, it was Michal's. And David had nothing to do with it. I don't know that. But that's very possible. You had, remember back in the incident with who was the lady that hid the teraphim by sitting on it? Was that Rachel? Rachel sat on it. So we do have historical precedent for the Jewish women were kind of shifty with their teraphim and would attempt to hide things from their husbands. But what else is new? Okay, So Michal, verse 13, took the household idol, laid it on the bed, put a quilt of goat's hair at its head, and covered it with clothes. So we have the guards coming in, and now we're down to our second set, and this would be the guards who were fooled. They come in, and they see the bed, at least at a distance. And when Saul, verse 14, sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. So the second set is fooled. So they go back, and then Saul sent messengers, that's the third set, to see David, saying, bring him to me on his bed, that I may put him to the death. When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was in the bed, and the quilt of goat's hair in its head, and they were deceived. So you have the third set coming into the picture and having been fooled. So Saul replies to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go that he's escaped? And Michal said to Saul, David said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death? In other words, he threatened my life if I didn't let him go and I didn't want to be killed. Now, a few observations on that. Number one, notice in this contest, Michal told two lies. He's sick, and he wasn't. He threatened to kill me, and he hadn't. So notice two lies. One to protect herself, namely, David threatened to kill me if I didn't let him go, and one to protect David by telling the guards that he was sick. And it's also interesting to note that Scripture does not pass any moral judgment on that. It doesn't condemn it. And that is important to keep in mind. It is not necessary, nor does the Bible, every time someone does something wrong, say, stop, see what they did wrong. The Bible simply doesn't do that. There are many times when the actions of men are recorded and they're neither condemned nor they're condoned. That's just the way it happened. And you come to this chapter and that's the way it happened. And that's the way it turned out. It does. You can say, well, why wouldn't God want to correct these lies on her part? No need to. God is sovereign over lies. And God was able to use those lies to deliver David, and that is the issue. The issue is the sovereignty of God in these circumstances that is there. He is sovereign over all of men's actions. Does not mean he condones them, but it does mean he is sovereign over them. It is ironical, isn't it? In these first two deliveries, who delivered David from Saul? Saul's daughter, Saul's son. kind of a little ironical thing the way this comes in here. Now, before we go to the psalm, let me read two. And I've kind of gotten amused in 1 Samuel of some of the older commentaries, some of the comments they make. And here are two interesting ones. Not particularly edifying, but they're interesting anyway. One old commentator is noting that David in chapter 19, beginning the chapter, Saul's trying to kill him. And he no more tries to kill him and deliver him, but lo and behold, he's in another mess. And he moves from that mess to the next mess and is continually in trouble. And the commentator says, "Oh my God, how wonderfully dost thou lead thy servants. Scarcely are they out of one trial when again thou stirrest up for them another. Blessed be the Lord." And I think you can probably identify with that. Is scarcely are we out of one trial when again thou, the Lord, dost stir up for us another. Now, I don't know about this one. He's talking about the plot of Michal. This is an old German commentator. He says, his observation, "In cases of urgent need, where there is no time for long reflection, a woman can more quickly devise a plan, far surpassing therein the male sex." Okay, now let's go to Psalm 59. Psalm 59, now as David goes out into the night, he's going to pen this beautiful psalm. Now we're moving from historical literature to the deeply devotional literature of the Old Testament. We're moving away from the historical narrative that simply notes the ruse of Michal and how he was let down, and we're coming now to a book that will give us some insight. And I like the way one person has put it. In the book of Psalms, we are given the medium through which we can gain insight into events that are only sketched in the historical book. So we've had an event sketched in 1 Samuel, and now we're going to get some insight into it. And what this psalm will give us is insight into the thinking of David as he escapes into the night, fleeing, expecting that he is going to be put to death by Saul in the morning. So the historical framework then is 1 Chronicles chapter 19. One other thing in introducing Psalm 59, notice when we come down to the opening verse, this is for the choir director. This is the Holy Spirit saying, look, the way David felt that night is the way lots of Israelites are going to fail. And the way he thought is the way they should think when under tempting and testing situations, so let's make it part of the hymn book. And of course, the Holy Spirit even thought further than that, because as David goes out into the night under the enormous pressure of the loss of his life and has the thoughts of Psalm 59, he said, "I want that recorded, so on the 17th of May 1987, believers at Bethaven Church can also identify with that." That's why the word is given to us. All right, we begin then in the psalm, and we won't get it all done tonight, but we begin with David's petition. Chapter 59, verses 1 through 8. And we open up with his need. Verses 1 and 2. Now, let me make a beginning observation. Lots of the psalms, and this is one of them, are filled with petitions. This one, however, is unusual. Normally, and remember when we studied the psalms, we noted that praise psalms have a certain format they follow. Petition psalms have a fairly common format they follow. And when we come to Psalm 59, this one is really different. The way it is different is in this. First of all, the petition is found first in this psalm, not later on like most of them do. And second, it is repeated four times, not one time. Reading, "Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Set me securely on high away from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who do iniquity. Save me from men of bloodshed." Four lines of petition first in the psalm. And you back off and look at that and say, well, here's a petition psalm, but this baby is different. Now, just to show the difference, keep your finger here or a pencil or something, and go to another one that's like it that is more according to form. It's Psalm 3. Psalm 3 is going to have petitions in it. O Lord, and notice the thing he calls attention to. O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Men are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. In other words, he describes his problem first. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice. He answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, and the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. So he goes from the description of the problem to the description of his trust in the Lord. Then verse 7, arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. Next line, for thou hast smitten all thy enemies. And notice the comparison. First of all, the petition is last. Way down in the psalm, tucked down, clear down of 8 verses, it's tucked into verse 7. And how many lines? Just one. One line later on. Now, do you get the contrast with Psalm 59? Four lines first. Now, why and what is that message? And the message of the first four lines of Psalm 59, can you think of anything that would explain why he had hit four petitions, not one, and why he'd hit it right off the bat? No description of the enemies. Think. Wouldn't you? I mean, my head is about to be lost in the morning. This is big stuff. So the message then is extreme urgency. David is simply saying, Lord, I don't have a whole lot of time this morning to tell you how great you are. I'm in trouble. We'll take care of that later. And notice where that he comes in there. Notice down in verse 16. But as for me, I shall sing of thy strength. You see, there are times when God understands his own children to be so desperate that he doesn't expect a full exposition of his character before we come to him with a petition. And David is right up front with this extreme urgency that is there. And that extreme urgency will be expressed in four lines. The first one is, deliver me. It's true in the English text and it's true in the Hebrew text. Notice the first word, deliver me. That word is a very, very interesting word. In the Old Testament, it's a word used for salvation. In both the Old Testament and the New Testament, the word save or deliver may be either spiritual or physical. Either one. It may be either physical delivery or spiritual delivery. And that's true in the New Testament also. In other words, when God talks about saving his people, he doesn't have one word for saving them physically and another word for saving them spiritually. Let me read you a couple in the New Testament and you'll see it. And ask yourself, physical salvation or spiritual salvation? Whenever you see the word save or deliver, you've always got to ask that. It's always important. Acts 16:31, believe in the Lord Jesus and you shall be saved. Physical, spiritual? Obviously, spiritual, isn't it? However, in Acts chapter 27, they're in the midst of a horrible storm at sea. They've jettisoned all the cargo, and they've arrived at a point where it looks like they're all going to drown. And Paul says, at that point, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. Saved spiritual? Did Paul lose his salvation in the ship at sea in the storm? Obviously not. The word being saved is being saved physically. The important point, it is the same word. And that is true in the Old Testament, and that is true in the New Testament. And we look at Psalm 59, deliver me or save me, physical, spiritual. Physical, obviously. At this particular point, his life is threatened. Now, we might add, however, with this particular word deliver, it almost always is used in the Old Testament for physical delivery. Just an exception or two. It's almost always the word used for physical delivery. Almost always. Occasionally this word, I think of maybe two places in Psalms where this particular word is used of spiritual salvation, but not normally. This is a physical salvation. So he begins and says, "Save me physically from my enemies, O my God." And that fits very well into 1 Samuel. So save me physically, right up front. The issue is physical salvation, delivery of his life. The second statement then is, "Set me on high." Set me on high. Now, I've left out the word securely. Notice it is in italics, and I agree that that's the idea. But literally, it means set me up high. The Hebrew verb, if you would go to a lexicon, and you would look in that lexicon for this particular word, which is spelled S-H-A-G-A-B, shagev, and it would say this. It would not say to be high. It says to be inaccessibly high. Emphasis in a place where you cannot be reached. Be inaccessibly high. It's used, for example, of a city set way up on a hill that could be defended. It was used for the tall walls of a city. And thus, it connotes security. And that's why you've got in the New American Standard the word securely in italics. It connotes security. So the idea is, set me securely on high, away from those who rise up against me. And David is simply saying, they have risen up, but Lord, I want you to lift me higher. They have gone to 10,000 feet. Boost me up to about 20 where they can't get any oxygen. And then help me breathe. It's the emphasis that he wants to be inaccessibly high. Interesting enough, the noun form of that word shagev is often translated tower. And it's the figure of speech that we'll talk about. The Lord is a tower. By the way, in this context, let me show you the noun form of that, set me on high. Go down to verse 9. Can you pick out the word in verse 9 that is the noun form of being set on high? Because of his strength I will watch for thee, for God is my tower, my stronghold. God is what he asks God to do in verse 1, God becomes in verse 9. He's his tower. He is his high place, and he is place of security. Now, if David wanted to be way up above his enemies, and you had the option of addressing God about boosting you way up there in the heights above your enemy, and you could say that in a matter-of-fact Cal stem in Hebrew, or a PL stem, or a Hefil, which means cause me to be high, which one might you guess that David probably used on this occasion? Yeah, he is PLing God. It's the Hebrew intensive stem. It's the intensive stem. He's saying, Lord, boost me out of reach. Rocket me as high as possible for delivery. Now, if you want to get a little bit of force of the word that he picked up for something being high and have a lot of distance between something, go over to Psalm 139 and I'll show you the word again. Psalm 139. And if you want a picture of distance between two things and how far he wanted God to boost him above his enemies, Chapter 139 of Psalms. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up. He's talking about God's omniscience. and he's going to compare God's omniscience to man's knowledge and says they're light years apart. So, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou dost know when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou dost understand my thought from afar. Thou dost scrutinize my path and my lying down. Thou art intimately acquainted with all my ways. He's building up how much God knows. Even before there's a word on my tongue, before the Lord, thou knowest it all. He knows all of my unspoken words before I even speak them. Thou hast enclosed me behind and before and laid a hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful to me. Shagab. It is high. And so if you want to think of what David has in mind of how far he wants God to boost him above his enemies, it's sort of like the distance between man's knowledge and the omniscience of God. And that's a long, long ways. That's what David has in mind in this line. All right, back to Psalm 59. Deliver me physically from my enemies, O God. That's up front. Set me way out of sight. Elevate me. Clear up above those who rise up against me. Deliver me. And that's not a new verb. That's the form we started the verse with. It's back to that physical deliverance again. Deliver me physically from those who do iniquity and save me from men of bloodshed. That word save me is the most common word in the Old Testament for salvation. It's used over 350 times, and it means literally to make a place wide and spacious. It's the idea of, can't you picture the idea of how with the soldiers of guards of Saul all around his house, how he probably felt a little bit closed in. And his prayer to God is, would you please make this place spacious so I have freedom to move? And therefore, the word save is to make a place wide so I can move. I won't be restricted anymore. And then find delivery. So this is right up front, his prayer for delivery or the need of David, Psalm 59, verses 1 and 2. Now, quickly moving into his innocence. We'll look at his innocence and stop there tonight. His innocence, verses 3 and 4. Now, as David cries out to the Lord for delivery, he focuses on three things. Them, namely the enemy, himself, and God. Verse 3. For behold, they have set an ambush for my life. Fierce men launch an attack against me. Emphasis on them. When he looked at the enemy, David said, I'm going to hide my head in the sand. I don't have a problem. When it came to his enemies, he was realistic. Realism. I'm being ambushed. There is attack against me. Then notice he focuses on himself. Not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. For no guilt of mine, they run themselves up against me. He focuses then on himself, and the emphasis would be there is no sin there. And he's not saying he is sinless. He's simply saying there's no sin that occasions what's about to happen to me. So it's interesting. Realistic about the problems. He looks at himself in this and says, am I right? I see the enemy. Am I right? Then he turns around and he looks at God. And when he looks at God, he says, arouse thyself. Now that's interesting, and I want to make a point on that tonight, and that's where we'll stop and close our study for this particular time. But notice, the word arouse means wake up. Does that sound a little reverent? Hey God, you know, whistles, wake up. And the assumption of it is very interesting. The assumption is that David has this perception that God is apathetic. And that God is inactive, or at least slow. Now, I see all kinds of wonderful, pious looks out there, but haven't you ever thought that? Have you ever been in a situation and thought God was just a little bit inactive, and you had to pull his chain, or he was a little apathetic, or if you're not willing to admit that much, you've at least observed that you've been in situations where he certainly wasn't as quick as he should have been. slow. I think it's interesting, and this is what David is saying. Lord, you asleep? Please wake up. And the assumption is that God is being apathetic toward his situation. And to that, God was highly offended. Very interesting. He was not offended. God is responsive to the perception of his own, even when that perception is inaccurate. You see, really, in a sense, isn't thinking God is inactive, isn't a little bit irreverent, really, to tell God to wake up? Isn't that really a thought that's unworthy of God? And may I take us down two practical roads at this particular time. There's no one sitting here that has not had that thought about God, that he's either slow or inactive or apathetic. And when we have that thought, we have two paths we can go down. We always take one of the two. We can take the one that David did or the one that we usually take. And the first one is we can go down the path of guilt. I shouldn't be thinking this way, so I won't tell man. It would ruin my testimony. And I won't tell God, for he would nuke me. And really, that expresses what we often think. The other path is we could be open like David was. David said, I have a perception that God is apathetic. Knock, knock, knock. God, would you please wake up? And God responds to that. And notice you have here all kinds of words to activate God. Arouse, that means to wake up. Help, notice your margin, means to meet. And see. So he says, Lord, what I want you to do is wake up. Would you please meet me? Would you please see me? I'm here. And that is the mentality of this particular song and psalm as he focuses on these things coming down to verse 4. We'll stop now. I'll let you guess where his thinking goes next. There is in verse 5 a single emphatic word. Anyone guess it? The word thou is an emphatic Hebrew pronoun. In verse 8, you have a second emphatic Hebrew pronoun. And see, often in Hebrew writing, they like to arrange things in the text so it's forceful. And notice what David does. In verse 5, we have God. In verses, and then in between, down to verse 8, you've got the enemy described. And in verse 8, you're back to God. Notice the form takes the enemies and puts God on both sides of them. Can you see what he's saying? I looked out that window, there's a guard. There's one at this window. I'm surrounded on all sides by the enemy. Well, in my mentality, it doesn't work that way. The enemy surrounds my house, but I'll tell you what, I can see in verses 5 and 8, we're going to put God around the enemy. And God is surrounding his enemies, and you see it by the form of the text. We'll pick up with that point next time. Father, we're thankful for your word and the strength of doctrine and the strength of truth, that you can be trusted, you can be believed, and just as with David, you are also our strong tower and our deliverer. And we're thankful for the insight into what David thought that night as he walks out into the darkness, expecting to be sought down and killed by the men of Saul, that he was able to lift his eyes and see in the midst of all of it your own plan and your affection and your salvation, for which we give you thanks in Christ's name. Amen.